Hello, this is Victor Perton, that Optimism Man, and you're listening to the Optimism Man podcast at the Centre for Optimism. Welcome back. Today we have a genuinely extraordinary guest, John Hagel, an old friend, remarkable thinker, and cherished advisory committee member at the Centre for Optimism. John's insights and ideas consistently challenge and inspire me, and I'm delighted to share this conversation with you. Based in Silicon Valley, John is passionate about opportunity and guiding people to opportunities. John's the author of several books and incredibly generous in sharing the wisdom he gleans from his journey as an explorer. Among his influential works, The Power of Pull remains one of my all-time favourites for his profound insights into harnessing potential in a connected world. His most recent book, The Journey Beyond Fear, has resonated deeply with audiences around the world, encouraging his readers to embrace a future driven by optimism, hope, and curiosity. John is an optimist, a true believer in the potential of people and organizations to thrive, adapt, and create a better future. Today, we'll delve into his journey, his philosophy, and what makes him optimistic. So let's get started. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So as you know, no one can join that Optimism Man podcast or visit the Center for Optimism without being asked that question, what makes you optimistic? So John, what makes you optimistic? Is your optimism shaped by your life experiences, your faith, the facts, or the people around you?
Wow. It's shaped by many things over time, for sure. But I'd say probably the thing that gives me the most optimism is looking at long-term trends in the world. If you pull back, not just for a year or 10 years or 100 years, but 1,000 years, and see the extraordinary progress that has been made around the world, even though there have been dips along the way, the progress continues. That's, I think, the basis for some pretty profound optimism that's going to continue. And then also being surrounded by people who are optimistic. One of the reasons I'm based here in Silicon Valley for over 40 years is because I was drawn by the optimism of the people in Silicon Valley. They're always focused on opportunity, and that reinforces my own optimism. And so many things.
And you weren't born there. I mean, moving to Silicon Valley and California was a choice. So do you want to share just a little bit of that life journey of yours and how it has influenced your optimistic outlook, that opportunity-oriented outlook, that pursuit of progress and curiosity and exploration?
Well, it's been a long life journey for sure, and to be continued. It's certainly not over yet. But the starting point for my journey was actually a very challenging childhood. I had a dysfunctional family and a lot of anger from my mother. And the way that I was able to maintain optimism was I would retreat to my bedroom and read science fiction novels. And at the time, it's interesting, at the time, all science fiction was about utopian futures, the amazing, wonderful things that were going to happen in the future. If you look at science fiction today, it's mainly dystopian futures. It's all about the terrible things that are going to happen in the future. But when I was a child, seeing that utopian future gave me some optimism that, as challenging as my childhood was, things would somehow unfold for the better. And so, and then another experience, kind of interesting, I grew up in a different country every year as a child. And when I was in third grade, I was living in Caracas, Venezuela, and I started playing hooky from school, not going to class. And I was wandering through the slums of Caracas, which were quite near my school. And what I was struck by was the optimism of the people in the slums. They had moved from rural areas to the city, the big city, because they saw opportunity. They were driven by opportunity. And yes, they were in poverty situations, but better than they were when they were in rural situations, and looking to the future to see opportunity. And so that gave me a sense that even in very trying and challenging areas, you can maintain optimism and pursue the optimism. So those were a couple of the early experiences that I think gave me, reinforced my sense of optimism.
But wandering through the slums in Caracas, I recall in Brazil, in Porto Alegre, I walked through one of the favelas and I was talking to the people. And exactly as you say, most of the people in the favela were people on the way up, moving from very poor agricultural backgrounds to the city, and for the first time having electricity, for the first time having running water. The favela was just so well organized. And I was fortunate the other day, an old friend of ours, Carol Graham from Brookings Institute, who started her research in development economics in Peru and looking at the social mobility of people who'd started off in a dirt-floored hut, in rural Peru, and through optimism and hustle. That notion of you've got five corn hobs and you barbecue three of them and sell them on a street corner was remarkable. So I think as a very young boy, I think you nailed, what has been a rich source of optimism and research.
Yeah, and it's, I've been driven, and initially, at least, it was instinctive. It wasn't intentional, but it was one of the reasons why I made a decision to move to Silicon Valley over 40 years ago. Was I had a sense that there was a sense of optimism here that is very rare in the world. I mean, yes, there's a lot of optimism, but here it's intense and passion that really is driving people, and they're constantly focused on what's the big next big opportunity versus what are the bad things that could happen. And I find that being surrounded by people who are optimistic is also very energizing and reinforces your own optimism.
I interviewed the author of True North, who was then the head of leadership at the Harvard Business School. And I said to Bill, "What makes you optimistic?" And he said, "Being surrounded by positive people. What a blessing." And I think
Yeah.
you share the same blessing.
Absolutely. And again, it's not just a blessing. It was something I sought, I looked for, because I knew that it would help me to strengthen and reinforce my own optimism if I could find others who shared it.
Well, my secular Bible, since you wrote it, was The Power of Pull, your seventh book, and written 2010, I think, and that's when we first met. And the thing that has constantly intrigued me and been at my forefront, talking to my teenage children, teaching classes in the Australian public service, is that notion of serendipity. And serendipity being, putting yourself in the right place for serendipity to work. So I regard you as the world expert on the application of serendipity in life. So would you like to explain what is serendipity and how do you see it playing a decisive role in the lives of the people who understand it?
Yeah, well, it's complicated. I mean, I think that people basically view serendipity as luck. I view it as unexpected encounters with people that, or things that could prove very helpful to you in your in whatever you're trying to do. And I think that the challenge is that for most people, because they view it as luck, it's something that's just going to happen by chance, and there's nothing you can do other than be prepared for it when it happens. So just, when it happens, embrace it. I've become a bit of a contrarian to say, no, actually, we can shape our serendipity. We can increase the likelihood of those unexpected encounters by the choices we make. And so, one of the things I talk about in shaping serendipity is just, what environments do you choose to live in? Just a simple example, if you're living in a small village where everyone knows everyone else, there's going to be very little serendipity versus if you're living in a big city where you're constantly running into people you never met before and who have very new and interesting ideas and perspectives. And by the way, in that context, I think cities where there are a lot of immigrants, of people who were not born in the city but came from different areas of the world, increase the unexpected encounters. You're going to encounter people that you never knew, existed. And so I think having that, choosing what environment you're going to live in is a way of shaping serendipity. And then another just simple example of shaping serendipity, in certainly in the business world, I focus on this a lot. If you're a business executive and you have your day mapped out from breakfast until dinner, appointments every single point along the way with people you know and or you know are trying to connect with, there's no chance for serendipity. The serendipity comes if you create some free time where you can wander through the halls or wander outside the building and run into people that you never expected. And I could go on forever, but one of my great examples too is going to conferences. One of the interesting people that I've been inspired by is an Israeli entrepreneur by the name of Yossi Vardi. He virtually every day of the year is at a conference somewhere in the world, almost every day. And the interesting thing about it is he never goes into the conference room. To the session room. He is sitting outside in the lobby or in the hallway and calling people over as they come by to start a conversation because these are unexpected encounters, people he doesn't know and may, have very interesting opportunity. But if you're just sitting there in the conference room listening to a speaker, maybe the speaker will give you some unexpected ideas and insights, but that's it. Versus no, interacting with more and more people creates a lot more insight and unexpected encounters. So I don't know. I've become very passionate about the need to really understand that we can shape serendipity and increase the likelihood of those unexpected encounters.
I'm such an avid follower of you on this because I remember you explaining that to me early up. And don't go to a session in a conference where you understand what's going on. Only go to the sessions where you probably don't even understand the language. And I did it the other day. I was at a conference in the Melbourne Exhibition Centre, and the convention side is one side and the exhibition's the other. And they had the coffee machine just inside the entrance of the exhibition. So I took a seat facing the door, and within 20 minutes, I had five people sitting down. Two people I knew vaguely, three people who were strangers, but who were friends of theirs. And the other one where you really taught me something was, in a cafe in Palo Alto, and you took the table nearest the door. And you were facing the door, and people would walk past and say, "Oh, look, I want to introduce you to X." And you'd say, "Oh, look, you've got my phone number. I've got half an hour later in the week." And I've really made that a principle now. And I teach it in the course when I teach influence in Australian public policy making. I say, "You've paid $5.50 for a coffee. You've paid for a seat. You've paid for a table. You don't need to take a takeaway cup back to the desk. Sit there pointing at the door." And I was very proud of my 19-year-old the other day because he did it instinctively. And years ago, he would have been embarrassed by me doing it. So you've had an extraordinary influence on me, and I'm trying to spread that gospel for you.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'm very passionate about it, as you can tell. I think that in a rapidly changing world, it's the things that are unexpected that really give us insight that's most valuable. And so I think serendipity is going to become more and more important to our progress and to achieving what we want to achieve.
And particularly with the capture of people by the smartphone. There are so many people walking down the street just focused on their phone, And not making eye contact. I was in New York in July, John, and I teach people to smile and say hello to everyone. And of course, New York's a challenging environment for that because a lot of people avoid eye contact. But I walked between Fifth Avenue and the UN building, and I ended up getting 12 people to interact with me and ended up having five conversations in those few blocks between Fifth Avenue and the UN building. So even in a tough environment like New York, you smile and you say hello, or if they open the conversation, say, what's been the best thing in your day? They're lovely opportunities to have those conversations. So I will actually, in gratitude, say thank you for teaching me that, 14 years ago, and it has so enriched my life, and those that I've told about it, I think it's enriched their lives too.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I think there's a lot more opportunity there for sure for all of
Well, I reckon there's a second edition of The Power of Pull in demand. I would
us.
certainly buy 25 copies straight off if there was a second edition. Now, thinking about leadership, so you've studied leadership, you've been around leaders, some of the most successful people in Silicon Valley, you've generated the success in them through your activity. So how does optimism influence your approach to leadership? Because my bias, my view is that 2020s demand infectiously optimistic leadership, if not magnetically optimistic leadership. So back to the power of pull. So how does it influence your leadership, but also the most successful leaders you associate with?
Well, I think it's the notion that the leaders that I find are the most effective are those that when they look into the future are seeing the opportunities that have not yet been achieved and what amazing things we could accomplish if we came together to achieve those opportunities. So that will they'll inspire and motivate the people that follow them to pursue those opportunities and overcome the fear and resistance they might have to change. And I think another key element is the emphasis of leaders on learning. I make the challenge that the mark of a strong leader in the large institutions around the world for the past century has been a leader who has the answer to all the questions. No matter what question, you can count on the leader to have an answer. That's a strong leader. And I think it's the reason why trust is eroding in all of our institutions, because if we have leaders who say they have the answer to all the questions, there are two possibilities. One is they don't understand how rapidly the world is changing, or they are lying. In either case, why would I trust them? And I believe the leaders that are going to be most effective in the future are going to be those who have the most inspiring questions and exciting questions about if we could come up with an answer to this, what could we accomplish? And ask for help from others, because that again starts to invite serendipity. If you're asking for help, you'll draw people to you you may never have met, but it turns out they have really interesting ideas and answers to those questions. So I think it's a profound shift in the leadership model that we are pursuing in all our organizations. But I think ultimately it's the leaders who are going to be most effective are those who really focus on the ability to achieve more and more of our potential. As participants, and not just for the leader, but for the participants. And here again, I get a bit contrarian because many people talk about achieving your full potential. Really? You're going to achieve your full potential? You'll never achieve your full potential. The more potential that you achieve, the more potential there is to achieve going forward. And so I think that again, the mark of a strong leader is someone who draws out that inspiration about we have so much potential to achieve. Let's get moving. Let's get started and come together to.
I often talk about Henry Kissinger, writing his last book at the age of 99, and still being asked to come and advise the Chinese leadership on, what's going on in the world. And I know one of your passions these days in curiosity, is longevity. I see you what I love about you, and I always, I tell people to subscribe to you on Twitter and Facebook because you're always sharing something that you've read. I think you take this view. There's no point reading it unless you share it.
Right.
Because, it moves so fast. But tell me about that passion of yours now, around longevity and what's happening in Silicon Valley in that area, and also AI. My little chat GBT and I, we chat to each other when I'm driving in the car. And this week she's been imitating Father Christmas. But I know you've got some really interesting views on both AI and longevity. So what are you seeing there?
Well, again, it's driven by my optimism. I think that if we have infinite potential to achieve, the longer we live, the more potential we will be able to achieve. And so why just focus on, waiting until we get sick and finding ways to treat the sickness? Why not find ways to become even more healthy? And I'm actually a proponent of reversing our aging. I think there's technology that's now being developed that will help us to actually reverse our aging and become younger biologically. And so why wouldn't we do that if we're really driven to achieve much more potential and have more impact? And I think I'm seeing around the world, but certainly in the US, this notion of longevity is becoming more and more interesting to people, and people wanting to learn more about it and pursue it. So I don't know.
Yeah, my mother, was a refugee twice. She was widowed twice, and yet she lived and worked to the age of 92, and always content, always passionate, always interesting. So I've set her as my model. I've set the initial target at continuing to work to 92. So we'll have to swap notes and do another one of these podcasts when I turn 92. I think you're a little bit older than me, but not much. So I reckon we'll have a good conversation at that time. Now, come back to curiosity. I'm often drive people nuts because I sing a little song from the 1973 version of Lost Horizon, the music of Burt Bacharach. And there's a funny scene in the middle where a comedian is teaching a group of children a pickup class. And he says, "What are you learning?" And they say, "French." And he says, "Well, look, I don't know any French." But he then sings a song, which is essentially, "Answer me a question, right or wrong. You can answer with a question, right or wrong. Even though your answer may be wrong, your question may be right." And so, in your most recent book, The Journey Beyond Fear, of course, the first pillar is curiosity. And if I can quote you back to yourself, just so that the listeners get the picture, you've written this: "In a rapidly changing world, curiosity becomes more and more essential. Curiosity has many different dimensions, but it essentially involves asking a lot of questions as we become intrigued by what we do not know. The strong desire to ask more questions can be a valuable way to launch us on our journey to learn more, but it is hardly sufficient. Exploration is about action, action beyond questions." So, what's that distinction you make between curiosity and the passion of the explorer?
Curiosity and exploration. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Curiosity and passion. Yes. Well, it's complicated. It's all connected. I've become, because of my research, I'm convinced that the world is changing at an accelerating rate. And in that kind of world, we need to be focused much more on learning than we have in the past. And learning in a very different form than most people. When I talk to learning about most to most executives, they say, "Oh, you're talking about training programs. We do training programs. We do a lot of learning." No. If that's learning in the form of sharing existing knowledge, and while I don't want to dismiss that, in a rapidly changing world, existing knowledge is becoming obsolete at an accelerating rate. So the key and most powerful form of learning is learning in the form of creating new knowledge that never existed before. And that's where curiosity starts to come in, because if you aren't asking questions, you're not going to start that learning process. The learning process starts with questions, things you don't know and things nobody knows. How could we come up with an answer? But again, it's complicated. I've come to believe, because of my focus on how to learn in the form of creating new knowledge, that if all you're doing is sitting there asking questions, yeah, you learn a little bit, but the most necessary form of learning is then taking action to try to find answers to those questions. That's exploration. If without action, you're just going to sit there thinking, and yeah, you may come up with some great ideas, but the most interesting ideas and powerful ideas come from action and reflecting on what impact was achieved from the action. It's not just action for the sake of action, it's action because you're trying to find an answer to the question. And how much of an answer did you come up with? What could you do to create even more of an answer, more insight into that question? And so that, to me, is exploration. It becomes a key follow-on or adjunct to curiosity. And I'll just add another, I call them capabilities, but to me, it's ex collaboration too. I mean, if you're just exploring as an individual, yeah, you might come up with great new insights and ideas as you do take action yourself. But if you're coming together with other people who share a passion for the question that you're asking, you're going to come up with better answers faster than you ever would alone. And so finding ways to collaborate, to come together and not just do it yourself, becomes critical to this form of learning.
Yeah, I did a session recently on policy with people in a federal government department in Australia, and luckily I had a whiteboard the size of the wall. And the question I can't the question is confidential, but it related to a very ticklish issue of Australian public policy. And having 12 other people in the room, the questions flowed. And you know, from the one initial question, we ended up with 100 questions. And I said to them, each of these questions is, in fact, answering, in some senses, the original. But I love that notion of the explorer. So I wrote a little blog piece this morning on using optimism in the treatment of soldiers with PTSD. And I could have just read the paper and summarized it, but I wrote to the professor from Yale who'd written it, and he gave me more insights. And you know, by my writing to him, I started another idea for him. And so I think, yeah, that notion again, you know, it's I'm such a follower of yours, and I think I've learned so much from you. And to me, that just makes such sense that you just don't stop at asking the question. You make questioning a group activity. And as you say, you then take action to find out the next bit.
And this all ties into my increasing focus on a specific emotion that I call the passion of the explorer. That if we're really committed to achieving more impact and addressing opportunities, we need to find within us a passion of the explorer. And I believe we all have it within us. It's waiting to be discovered. But it's based on research that I've done where I looked at environments where there's sustained extreme performance improvement. And I said, what can we learn from those environments? One of the things was that despite the very diverse environments, all the participants had a very specific form of passion, which I've come to call the passion of the explorer. But the three elements: one is people who have this passion are really excited about having more and more impact in a specific area, specific domain. They're not just wanting to be in the domain, not just wanting to learn about it, hear about it. They want to have more and more impact in that domain. Second, they're excited about confronting unexpected challenges because that's going to give them an opportunity to learn and have more impact than they had before. And then the third element is when they confront those unexpected challenges, their first reaction is, who else can I connect with who can help me come up with a better answer faster? And they're driven to connect. And one of the things I find is people who have this passion tend to come together into small groups. I've come to call them impact groups, but they're typically between 3 to 15 people who share that passion for more impact and are constantly on the one side supporting each other when they don't succeed. Not to worry, we have your back. but on the other side, challenging each other to say, how can we have even more impact? What do we need to do to learn faster and have more impact? And that drives a lot of learning and reinforces the passion of the people because they're seeing other people share that excitement about having more impact.
Yeah, in the past you've talked to me, that's almost the structure of evangelical churches. These super churches, where people think it's the 20,000 people gathering on a Sunday. But I think you've said to me when you've studied these organizations, their strength is in the little household gatherings on a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Thursday, where they have, some drinks or coffee or tea and share those passions.
Yeah, there's an author by the name of Malcolm Gladwell who wrote an article about the evangelical movement. He called it the cellular church, and that was his point, that the real impact of the evangelical movement is coming from these small impact groups that come together outside the Sunday ceremony, but focused on action in their local community and how they can have more and more impact. And I've studied movements throughout history, movements for social change, and one of the things I've found is that the most successful movements in having impact are those who have a cellular structure, who organize in small groups, small cells, where people have a real passion and where the focus is on what I would describe as an opportunity-based narrative. It's all about what amazing things could we accomplish if we came together versus focusing on the terrible things that are happening. No, yes, there are obstacles, there are barriers, there are enemies that we need to overcome, but the real focus is on the opportunity. What could we accomplish if we all came together? And that inspires and motivates people to want to take risk and come together to drive the change.
So taking risk, the other day I actually had a debate with a psychologist who had an hour and a half to lecture me on safe workplaces. And whilst the notion of, going to work and being safe at work is one thing, but this constant reiteration of psychologically safe workplaces, psychosocial safety, I think is diminishing the opportunities for innovation and bravery. And funnily enough, I spoke to the psych a few days later, and this morning he sent me his thoughts on creating a braver workplace. I think even though he lectures us on these things, he has shares the same skepticism. So innovation and optimism, they live together, don't they, as husband and wife or partners. I had a researcher from Canada who researches mindsets at work, and she said pessimists can't innovate. They're too ground down in what went wrong. The optimist says shit happens and you move on.
And I just want to go back to this notion of safe workplaces because, again, I tend to be a bit of a contrarian in the sense that in many large organizations, the interpretation of safe workplaces is don't challenge each other, support each other, embrace whatever they say and encourage them, and that's a safe environment. And again, my experience is if people have this passion of the explorer, they're constantly challenging each other, but they're doing it with respect. And in the traditional environment, if you challenge somebody, it's to put them down, it's to dismiss them. Versus, no, if you have share a passion, you're challenging each other because you share a commitment to have more and more impact. And you're not going to do it just by saying, yes, let's do this, whatever you say. No, how could we do something even better? How could we have even more impact? And so I think that we need work environments where we're constantly challenging each other, but with respect and excitement about the opportunities, the optimism about what we can achieve.
Maybe I'm a bit idiosyncratic there. I often say it's the difference between using the word but and the word and, even if it's the long Australian sarcastic version of and. And I also think, I mean, again, correct me if I'm wrong, Australian universities encourage critical thinking, but critical thinking has become critical rather than that notion of looking clearly. And I must say I've become a big fan of appreciative inquiry. Where do you
Gotcha.
stand on critical thinking versus appreciative inquiry?
No, I'm certainly a big fan on appreciative inquiry. It's this, definitely the notion of embracing but wanting to pursue further and get even more impact, and recognizing that together we can come up with things that neither of us would have come up with on our own.
One of the things, I've got two great friends in the area of narrative and storytelling. You are the
No.
great, one of the great global challenge champions of narrative, enriched by story. My friend Sean Callahan from anecdote.com is a great champion for the notion of business storytelling. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that difference you see in the virtues of narrative versus story? And the way in which people can use narrative, to be more innovative and to be more effective.
Yeah, it's complicated. Again, I think most people, when I say na talk about narrative, say, "Oh, you're talking about story." It's the word, they're synonymous. They mean the same thing. No, I make a distinction. For me, a story is self-contained. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end to it. The end, the story's over. And the story is about me, the storyteller, or some other people, real or imagined. It's not about you, the one listening to the story. And in contrast, for me, a narrative is open-ended. There is some kind of big threat or opportunity out in the future, not clear whether it's going to be achieved or not. And the resolution of the narrative hinges on you. It's a call to action to say your choices, your actions are going to help determine how this narrative plays out. And I find that it's a very powerful way to be a catalyst to bring people out of fear and into optimism and opportunity, if you can really focus on opportunity-based narratives. One example I give, just to, and by the way, narratives in the way I think about it evolve at many different levels. It starts with a personal narrative. What's your narrative about the future? And what's your call to action to others? Then there are corporate or institutional narratives. There are geographical narratives, and there are movement narratives. And just a quick example of an institutional narrative, because again, when I talk to executives, they say, "Oh, yeah, we have a narrative. We began in a garage, we faced incredible obstacles, we overcame them, we accomplished amazing things, and there's more to come. That's our narrative." No, my challenge is that's about you. What is it about the people you're addressing outside your company? What's the opportunity for them, and what action do they need to take? And the example that I give, and it's one of the few that I have, I welcome other examples, but it's Apple Computer in the 1990s. Steve Jobs came up with a narrative that was about, digital technology for decades took away our names, gave us numbers, put us in cubicles, made us cogs in a machine. Now, for the first time, there's a generation of technology that can enable us to achieve more of our potential and in unique individuality. But it's not going to happen automatically. You need to think different. Will you think different? And it's the reason why I think for many people, Apple became the equivalent of a religion. It talked about such a deep aspiration that people had, and it was about them. It wasn't about Apple. It was about them and the action they needed to take. And yes, Apple could be helpful along the way, but it's about them. And just as an aside, too, I think one of the reasons I'm so passionate about these narratives is that narrative of think different. First of all, one of the ways that he made it very effective was by telling stories about people who had thought different and what they were able to accomplish. So stories in the context of a broader narrative can be very powerful in driving more excitement about the opportunity in the narrative. And I think that that's a big potential, but also it helped to inspire and motivate a growing number of third-party companies, software companies, device manufacturers, who are all excited about this notion of thinking different and helping people to think different. And they came up with more and more different options to add on to the Apple, basic Apple computer. And it created a huge network ecosystem of innovation that was very powerful.
I you make me in the, as you know, I come out of politics, so the political sphere, but I still remember Teddy Kennedy's eulogy to his brother Robert, where he said, some men see things as they are and ask why, but he dreamed things that have never been and asked why not. And Bill Clinton, who 30 years later, followed in that same mode, with his theme song of Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. That inspiration that carried him through, sort of, because 40 minutes have flown by, and I know
Oh,
I could talk to you for hours and hours, but your time is valuable. So coming back to your book, The Journey Beyond Fear, I live in Australia. Our news media is constantly stimulating pessimism and fear. We even have weather. It's a hot day now. It's called catastrophic weather conditions. There's been no catastrophe yet, but we are being drowned down in fear that a catastrophe will happen tomorrow because it's going to be 43 degrees Celsius. So, I love your book and it's popular and you're talking around the world. How can people use, those pillars you've got in that book? First, number one, read the book, I think is my strong recommendation. But in short, in a media environment where fear and catastrophe is emphasized, good news passes by without being covered. How can we use that wisdom you've shared in The Journey Beyond Fear?
Well, as the title suggests, it's a journey. It's not something that can happen overnight. But again, it's based on research that I've done, as well as part of it's a personal memoir, how I evolved in the journey beyond fear. But one of the key things that I think people can start to do at an early stage is step back and articulate what is their personal narrative. And I think here the two key questions are, is your view of the future primarily threat or opportunity? And what's your call to action to others? Do you have a call to action to others? And I think more and more people, when they go through this exercise, are realizing their view of the future is threat-based. It's focused on threats, the terrible things, and the fear. And there's not a call to action to others because they can't trust anybody. They've got to do it all themselves. It's all on their shoulders. And I think just going through that exercise gives people some insight to say, is this really the narrative that is going to be most effective for me in terms of achieving impact that's meaningful to me and to those who matter to me? And it starts to be a catalyst to drive people beyond fear to say, what are the opportunities in the future that could really excite and motivate me? And where I could have call others to come and join me in addressing those opportunities. So it's not just me. But I think that that is a starting point, and it's recognizing too that, as you said, a lot of the world around us is driven by what I would describe as threat-based narratives. It's all about the terrible things that are going to happen in the world, and it's feeding the fear. It's not just the media. I believe our political environment increasingly is driven by threat-based narratives, and it's movements, social movements for change. I mean, I give the example of climate change just to be provocative. But the whole focus of the climate change movement is a threat-based narrative. The world's going to collapse. We're all going to die. We need to move now and change. What's the opportunity? What amazing things could we accomplish if we all came together to build a flourishing world for everyone, not just humans, but animals, plants? What could we accomplish? Who's addressing that? And so I think we need in at the movement level to understand that threat-based narratives are not very effective in motivating people to take action. They start to become afraid, they become more isolated, they become more resistant to taking risk, and
I often say pessimism paralyzes, and Australia now has 23 national crises, from housing to aged care and the like, all things that are long-term issues. But the rhetoric now is it's a crisis. And we have three national emergencies as well. So I don't know how the Prime Minister even gets out of bed contemplating how he's going to deal with 23 crises and three national emergencies. And so Australia, we've had a 10% reduction in national productivity. We've had seven, even though we've got national growth, but it's covered by migration. We've had 7 quarters of diminishing GDP per capita. And so I actually think this notion of the crisis and the emergency and the threat-based narrative is weighing down a country that has typically been regarded globally as relentless optimists. I still remember Governor Perry of Texas saying to me, "We Texans are the lost tribe of Australia." That notion of, the shared love of a barbecue, the shared notion of a beer, and the shared notion of getting on with it. So I think the point you make, and in fact, GHD, the big engineering firm, recently did a study on leadership. The five countries that had the worst attitude were all English speaking. So it was Australia, the UK, the United States, Canada, and New Zealand. And so
Interesting.
there's something happening. Now, Steven Pinker at Harvard, talks about, in the 1970s, the news was 50-50 good, bad. Today, it's 95 to 98% bad. So I just wonder whether it's worse in the English-speaking world. And, we're seeing optimism rising in South Asia, rising in Africa, rising in Latin America. Is it something that's happening in the English language?
I've traveled around the world, and I have to say that my belief is that this notion of the emotion of fear is becoming more and more prevalent everywhere in the world. It's different threats, different things that are challenging people. But when I go to South Asia, South America, they're all very focused on the threats that are coming and how to survive.
So is it the zeitgeist, or is there a commercial gain in creating this environment of fear?
Well, the people say there's this commercial gain, but on the one hand, I get the challenge from people saying, "Oh, come on, John. Most of us, biologically, as humans, we're driven by fear. That's the amygdala. That's how we're designed." And certainly, I will acknowledge the role of the amygdala, but my challenge back is, tell me one person who wants to live in fear. Is there anybody you know? No, none of us want to live in fear. We all have a hunger for hope and excitement, but who's feeding that hunger? And I believe there's actually a pretty significant commercial opportunity for those who have come forward and start to really focus on the inspiring things that could bring us all together. And so I'm an optimist that this will change and that we'll see the shift from threat-based narratives to opportunity-based narratives. And
So, in Yiddish, there's the concept of menschlichkeit, the art of being human. And I often think of you as a mensch. And, in your Twitter feed and the like, you often share music, and laughter and humor. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about that? Your love of music. And I saw that Dionne Warwick is, even at her advanced age, is coming back to Australia to sing. And I said to my sister, "I'm going to buy a ticket." Those great songs, "Do You Know the Way to San Jose?" And
No, it's very interesting to me. I find music to be very inspiring and energizing, and I love live music, especially not just listening to it on a radio or telephone, but actually going to a live music performance. It just gives me so much energy, and there are some forms of music that are, again, much more dystopian or putting people down, To me, the music that's most inspiring is that where it's about opportunity and energy. And the interesting thing to me, one of my favorite genres of music is the swing music from the 1920s and 1930s and jazz. But it's interesting because that emerged in the United States during the height of the Depression. Yet it was a form of music that was really focused on exciting people and motivating people to come together and do great things, dance and have fun. And it just Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, there are a whole bunch of great musicians from that period. But it was interesting to me that as inspiring and exciting as the music is, it came to fruition in a very dismal time. I mean, we should have all been very depressed and fearful, and yet this music was helping to keep people moving.
Yeah, I am. When I'm teaching, at the end of each coffee break and lunch break, I always play some music. And whether it's the Beatles, Things Are Getting Better Every Day. And last year, I had the wonderful excitement. A teacher in Scotland read her grade six class, my book, Optimism, the How and Why. And these 11 and 12-year-old Scottish children with these heavy Glasgow accents got together with their teacher and did a rap version of Optimistic. And I just love, these 10 kids are on the screen singing OPTIM and go on and sing. And it's glorious if we can include it in our work. Look, I wanted to throw something at you. As you know, I've been researching this space of leadership and optimism for 10 years now. And Rob Masters and I have synthesized our research to one sentence, the optimism principle. Optimism is the answer to life's most pressing questions. Optimism is the answer to life's most pressing questions. What do you reckon?
It's I my tendency is to go beyond optimism because I think optimism is a key foundational element. But to me, this passion of the explorer is really what is going to be the answer to all the questions, that if you can really bring out that passion and come together with others to pursue it and take action versus just being optimistic and saying, oh, wonderful things are going to happen. No, it's that commitment to action and impact and learning and achieving more and more impact over time and excitement about it that I think is really, what drives progress.
Beautifully put, a good challenge. Martin Seligman said to me, my original research question is what makes you optimistic? And Seligman had just written his new book on hope. And he said, look, Victor, I think you could include optimism and hope. Although my prejudice against that is that the Archbishop of Canterbury has just resigned and the Pope always distinguish between hope and optimism. And I say you can have both, but they always argue against optimism in favor of hope. So I've kept my question quite simple. University of Sydney Business School in October published a study, 25 years of OECD data, and they entitled it The Optimism Effect. And they reckon that 25 years of OECD data, so basically 2000 to last year, shows that optimistic companies, optimistic countries do better in capital formation, innovation, and productivity. So what do you reckon about that optimism effect? That the optimistic leader in corporation or country does better in capital formation and certainly does better in productivity and innovation.
Yeah, again, it's complicated. I think that I would certainly agree that optimism, again, is the foundational element. If you're not seeing opportunity in the future and being optimistic about it, you're not going to make a lot of progress and do a lot of innovation. But again, if it's just optimism, is that enough? I mean, again, I think you have to have that passion about action and impact and progress in impact, achieving more and more impact over time, learning from the impact that really drives the innovation and learning and success in the companies or business. If a leader is just giving optimistic speeches, about how wonderful the world's going to be, okay. That's certainly better than talking about the terrible things that are going to happen. But if you're not following it with action and impact and learning, it's going to be hard to drive the change that we need.
It's interesting the point you make, because Joe Biden is constantly saying, "I'm optimistic for America." And Rishi Sunak's speechwriters probably copying Biden. Rishi Sunak in Britain was saying, "I am optimistic for the United Kingdom and England." And in Australia, our Prime Minister, again, the speechwriters, I think, all look at each other's. But I'd love them to ask the people, what makes you optimistic? Rather than telling them that they're optimistic. So I think you've nailed that. It needs a broader community. It needs to expand the passion. So thinking about the passion and the curiosity and the explorer, we're recording this as we're approaching the new year in 2025. So what are you most optimistic about, most passionate about for 2025 and beyond?
Oh man, so many things. I guess the thing I'm most passionate about is because I've gotten such great response on the book, The Journey Beyond Fear, I'm actually planning to create a new center that will offer programs to help people on the journey beyond fear. And so I'm very passionate about that, excited about it. And I've done some pilot programs that indicate that that's been very helpful to the participants. So I'm excited about helping people to make the journey beyond fear.
Well, count us in and count our listeners in, to support you in doing that. Now, for
Thank
people who are listening who want to become more optimistic,
you.
want to be able to pursue these passions, what are some of your tips and tricks that they could either adopt in a New Year's resolution or they can start using in their daily lives?
Again, I think that the starting point is just to step back and reflect on their personal narrative and really say, what is it that's driving me at this point? What view of the future is really shaping my choices and actions? Is it threat or opportunity? And where and how am I issuing a call for action to others? And I'm a believer that that can be a strong catalyst to bring people beyond fear. It's also just recognizing that fear is a very limiting emotion, I think, and even acknowledging the fear. I think for many people, we live in cultures where acknowledging fear is a sign of weakness. If you're afraid, you're a weakling. So, no, I'm not afraid. No, not at all. But I think more and more people are feeling the fear, and they need to re recognize, first of all, they have the fear, and second of all, that it's very limiting, and then start to explore ways to move beyond it.
Brilliant. So you're in high demand as a speaker in conferences and boardrooms. So how can the people listening today, obviously number one, buy your book, The Journey Beyond Fear? I'd say if they can find a copy of the older book, The Power of Pull, I'd commend that as well. But how can they connect with you and learn more from, those daily things that you share?
Well, I should say that all of my books, my first book was in 1976, and it was on alternative energy technologies. Back in 1976, I was talking about wind, solar, hydrogen. I was focused on opportunities in the future from the very beginning of writing these books. All my books are driven by, inspired by opportunities in the future and wanting to inspire others. So I would certainly recommend, all my books, but certainly the most recent one, The Journey Beyond Fear, is I think the most timely and relevant right now. And I have a website, johnhagel.com, that people can go to where I collect a lot of the research that I've done and blog posts that I do. And they can sign up for email lists. And I'm active on social media, as you mentioned, LinkedIn, Facebook, what used to be Twitter, now X. So they can connect on all those social media platforms as well. And I look forward to learning more about them.
Well, John, thank you so much for spending time with me and our audience today. I have admired you from the first time we met. And I still remember when I was setting up the Center for Optimism, you rang me up and you said, "When are you coming to California next?" And I said, "Well, funnily enough, I'm coming next week." And you said, "Come and meet me in Half Moon Bay." And you offered to join our advisory committee, and every piece of advice you give me, I haven't executed them all as well as I should have. But every piece of wisdom you've given me, I value intensely. So, John, best wishes for Christmas, the new year, and may 2025 be your best year ever.
Same to you. Absolutely. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for joining me for this inspiring conversation with John Hagel. I hope you found it as thought-provoking and energizing as I did. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out our other podcast episodes where we explore optimism in leadership, innovation, and everyday life. I'd also love for you to join us at the Center for Optimism, our global community of like-minded individuals and organizations dedicated to fostering an optimistic and positive outlook, and like John, pursue opportunity. So visit our website at the Center for Optimism to learn more and become part of the movement. And don't forget to connect with me on social media. You'll find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook, platforms where, like John, I love to share what I'm learning about optimism every step of the way. Let's keep the conversation going, and together, let's spread optimism. It's much needed. Until next time, stay optimistic and keep shining bright.